Universal Time. Stay tuned for Daybreak Africa coming up after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Lori London reporting. Back on the campaign trail, a reflective Hillary Clinton said Thursday that her doctor-mandated break to recover from pneumonia gave her some new perspective on why she's running for president.
Standing up for children has been the work of my life. As a lawyer with the Children's Defense Fund, as First Lady in Arkansas, in the White House, as a senator, I have fought for kids housed in adult jails. Kids who've been neglected and abused, kids who couldn't get health insurance because of pre-existing conditions, kids with disabilities so they could go to school.
Donald Trump spent Thursday laying out his plans to lower taxes by $4.4 trillion over a decade and cut regulations, including some of those intended to protect food and air.
Over the next 10 years, our economic team estimates that under our plan, the economy will average 3.5% growth and create a total of 25 million new jobs.
With 2 weeks remaining in the fiscal year for refugee and aid agencies around the United States in the middle of what's projected to be one of the busiest months for arrivals in at least a decade following a surge to bring in more Syrians fleeing civil war and Islamic State. By September 15th, nearly 79,000 refugees from 78 countries have come to the U.S. since October. The U.S. refugee program still expects to release or reach the target of 85,000 arrivals by the end of this month. This is VOA. UN officials say humanitarian convoys are ready to go at any time to Syria's northern city of Aleppo and other areas where people are badly in need of aid but are unable to move until they get authorization from the Syrian government. VOA's Isha Saria reports.
In Geneva Thursday, Special Envoy Stéphane de Mistura said the Syrian government was expected to provide facilitation letters which would give access to aid convoys.
The UN is ready to go. Those facilitation letters, i.e. final permission for the UN to actually reach those areas, have not been received.
The aid deliveries are part of a ceasefire agreement brokered by the United States and Russia, which went into effect on Monday. UN officials say the halt in fighting is largely holding, but the humanitarian effort is losing time thanks to the bureaucratic delays. Officials are hopeful that deliveries can be made to Aleppo on Friday. Isha Sarai, VOA News, Washington.
A new poll shows American Jews are unhappy with the way the ultra-Orthodox stream of Judaism dominates religious affairs in Israel. The poll, commissioned by the Jerusalem Post and the American Jewish Committee, and was released Thursday, which shows a growing deep rift between U.S. Jews and the State of Israel. The results come amid tensions over Israel's failure to carry out an agreement to allow non-Orthodox prayers at Jerusalem's Western Wall and the holiest site where Jews can pray. The majority of those polled support egalitarian prayers at the site and allowing liberal denominations to conduct weddings and conversions. In Japan, dressed in white pantsuit, the new head of Japan's main opposition party stood out as she raised her hands on stage with three other dark-suited party leaders. She generally goes by only her first name, but is one of three women who have assumed prominent political posts in recent weeks in a country more known for its male-dominated political and business hierarchy. U.S. stocks changed course again Thursday and climbed as Apple led a big gain for technology companies and energy companies, recovered some of their recent losses. Investors looked over a series of mixed economic reports as they sought clues about the Federal Reserve's intentions and the health of the economy. Technology companies made the largest gains as Apple rose for the fourth consecutive day. It's up 12% this week on growing optimism about early sales of its newest iPhones. This is VOA News.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
America. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Barty in Washington. Today is Friday, September 16th, and here are some of the stories we are covering. A Nigerian army general says Boko Haram's ability to take and hold new territories has been almost eliminated.
The ability of the Boko Haram terrorist group to move freely as they were doing before, the ability to take on territories has been virtually eliminated.
Lieutenant General Toku Burate is Nigeria's Chief of Army Staff. Ghana's presidential candidates collect their nomination papers ahead of the December 7th election. Ivory Coast government evicts tens of thousands of cocoa farmers from a national park. And a compromise has been reached to clear the path for election in the Democratic Republic of Congo.
The leader of the opposition delegation to the talks, Vital Kamerhe, told reporters, "We had to find a solution very quickly, and we agreed that we must find an order that does not violate the constitution."
That view is William Klaus in Kinshasa. Analysts say an arms embargo against South Sudan is better late than never, and South Africa protesters use fire to illuminate grievances. Those stories, plus our listener of the day, are coming up on Daybreak Africa. Nigeria's Chief of Army Staff says terrorism is a global threat that must be eliminated through a concerted worldwide action. Lieutenant General Toku Burate says the Nigerian Army has made tremendous progress in its fight against the Boko Haram terrorist group. General Burate is in the United States to speak to the Africa Center of the Washington-based Atlantic Council on Terrorism Matters. His trip comes days after Boko Haram released a new video that does not include the group's leader, Abubakar Shakur, but shows hundreds of poorly fed supporters. It also comes at a time that the military has not been able to liberate the 276 Chibok girls kidnapped 2 years ago from a secondary school in Borno State. General Burate says the army has completely eliminated Boko Haram's ability to take and hold new territory.
It is interesting to note that the ability of the Boko Haram terrorist group to move freely as they were doing before, the ability to hold ground, the ability to take on territories or ransack large communities and towns has been virtually eliminated. This is well known to everyone, and the success can be attributed to the political leadership of our country, Nigeria. You know how committed Mr. President and Commander-in-Chief, that's President Muhammadu Buhari, is to the fight against insecurity in the country, Nigeria. This is a motivating factor where the military and indeed its leadership took it upon themselves to ensure that the mandate of Mr. President is achieved, and in collaboration with the multinational joint task force and indeed with the intelligence agencies of our country, concerted efforts have been made to ensure that the Boko Haram terrorists are finally routed out of our own region, that is the Lake Chad Basin Commission region.
Boko Haram this week released a new video that really did not include its leader, Abubakar Shakur, but which suggests that the group is still potent. What's your interpretation of that video?
I saw the video, and it seemed to me it's just a propaganda. Those are just makeups by these Boko Haram terrorists. Virtually, they want to show that they are still around. To the best of our knowledge, and all well-meaning Nigerians who know the happenings in the Northeast, they know that those are just empty, boastful position of the Boko Haram terrorists. They have nothing to show, and indeed, they are just trying to show their prowess in terms of propaganda.
You have not been able to liberate the Chibok girls. I mean, if you can give me just a comment in terms of the progress you are making or lack of it.
The issue of the Chibok girls, we see it in a holistic approach. It is an approach that involves all the abducted persons within the Northeast. The Chibok girls are just a part of those persons that have been abducted. And we've continued to see that we rescue all the abducted persons. And we've been receiving some leads and we've explored those leads, and in most cases, virtually most of the leads that we got have proved to be incorrect. And we continue to receive more, and we continue to explore the leads to the whereabouts of all the abducted persons, including the Chibok girls, until they are all rescued. This is a commitment. The government is concerned. The military is concerned also, and indeed all many Nigerians are concerned. This is not an issue that we will take it lightly, and we make sure that within the available intelligence and within the limit of some of the challenges at a particular time, we'll be able to go around and get everybody rescued by the grace of God.
Lieutenant General Tukur Burate is Nigeria's Chief of Army Staff. He spoke with me yesterday in our Washington studio. Ghanaian President John Dramani Mahama of the ruling National Democratic Congress Party, May opposition leader Nana Addo Dankwa Akufo-Addo from the New Patriotic Party, and other presidential candidates have picked up nomination documents from the Electoral Commission ahead of the December 7th general poll. Electoral Commission spokesman Eric Zapasu tells reporter Peter Clotty that September 29 and 30th are the only dates that the Electoral Commission has set for the official nomination of all candidates who want to participate in the elections.
The key requirement for the processing of the nomination form to make it valid for the filing is that each presidential candidate should be able to get 2 registered voters per each district assembly administrative area in the country. We have about 216 of the districts, so the requirement is that you'll be getting 432 signatories across the country to endorse your candidature.
The last election, some opposition parties claimed that they were sabotaged for not being able to pick up their nomination forms or properly finish the process before submitting their papers to the Electoral Commission. What are some of the challenges that they have to overcome in order for this time around not to say that they were undermined by one party or the other, or perhaps by the Electoral Commission for thwarting their efforts to participate in the presidential or parliamentary elections?
In 2012, it is very true, some political parties and some candidates couldn't file their nomination for the simple reason that they failed to satisfy the legal requirements as stated in the law. So this year round, the laws are available to them. The onus is on them. They have a duty, they have a responsibility to fully comply with the requirements for the filing of the nomination. You know, for a presidential candidate, you need to get the 232 signatories to sign the form. You must have a vice presidential candidate. You need to sign a statutory declaration to the effect that you are qualified to be elected as a president or a member of a parliament. In addition to this, you must provide 4 bus size red background pictures, and then you pay your nomination fee of 50,000 Ghana cedis. And this process must be done between the hours of 9 and 12, and then between 2 o'clock and 5 p.m. on the 29th and 30th September. Failing to comply with any of these requirements of the law would amount to a rejection of your nomination by the Electoral Commission.
You mentioned the nomination fees for the presidential election of 50,000 Ghana cedis. Some political parties have expressed concern about it. They said this was a calculated attempt by the Electoral Commission to put pressure or to sideline the minor, so-called minor political parties.
Our laws mandate the Electoral Commission to determine a filing fee, which is essentially a deposit, which will be deposited by each candidate who wants to contest the election. Now, when the fee of 50,000 Ghana was mentioned at the Inter-Party Advisory Committee level, some of the political parties, in fact, most of the political parties, raised concerns about the level of the fee. They complained that it was rather too high. So, at the end of the day, what the commission said was that, one, it has taken notice of the concerns of the political party, and that, two, commission will consider the possibility of a review. And if the commission decides to review, it will communicate to the political parties and the decision arrived at. And where they think there will be a review, they will communicate to the political parties. Otherwise, the fees remain as they are.
Irakizak Basu is spokesman for the Electoral Commission of Ghana. He spoke with reporter Peter Clotty from the capital, Accra. You're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Butt in Washington. Today's Friday, September 16th. Daybreak Africa time is coming up at 16 minutes past the hour. The Ivory Coast government has evicted tens of thousands of cocoa farmers from Mount Pico National Park. According to Human Rights Watch, the evictions are part of a move by the authorities to protect the environment and combat illegal cocoa exploration. But this week, the Ivorian Coalition of Human Rights Actors warned that the government has not lived up to its initial plan of providing humanitarian assistance to the farmers that it has displaced. Human Rights Watch's West Africa researcher Jim Warmington tells Ricky Schreier that conservation efforts must not come at the expense of local residents.
So what we've seen is tens of thousands of farmers and their families leaving the lands that they'd relied on for years for their income and really having no viable place to go. They've settled in villages around the park, doesn't have the sanitation, doesn't have an alternative source of food or income for them. And therefore, they're living as displaced persons without really any way to support their families.
Is this area of Ivory Coast, I know it's near the Liberian border, is this one of those areas that's already had an influx of people to and from Liberia and Ivory Coast because of civil conflicts in the past? And so that maybe raises the issue that this might lead to tensions, I guess, in the area?
Yes, certainly the problem of illegal cocoa farming in Mompeko is related to Cote d'Ivoire's crisis. The crisis that began even as far back as 2002 made it very difficult for the Ivorian government to really maintain control of the forest. And that created space both for rebel groups, but also for sort of more mercenary farmers to either go into the park themselves or to install proxies that would conduct the illegal farming and then give the rebels a cut of the profit. There's certainly the reason for the illegal farming is connected to Cote d'Ivoire's conflicts. And even very recently, the United Nations group of experts who monitor many things, but including illegal natural resource board protection in Cote d'Ivoire, they had said senior members of the Ivorian army, including a commander called Luseni Fofana, was benefiting directly from the illegal cocoa farming that was going on in Mompeko.
What has been the government's response to this, that they have not provided adequate housing, alternative housing to these farmers who have been evicted? Are they saying they're working on it, or have they responded at all to this?
No, they have responded, and the government has put together at a national level and also in Duekwe, which is the nearest major town, working groups to try and work on the humanitarian response. I think international humanitarian groups have also realized that this is a potentially dangerous situation and have also tried to kind of step up their assistance in the area. You know, I think the government needs to continue to do that and needs to take responsibility for the welfare of a situation that it created. But I also think that there's lessons to be learned here in future, which is that if you are going to plan for such a large-scale operation to protect the environment, then really the protection of the people living in that area needs to be a top priority, both for their own benefit, but also because that's the most effective way in the long term of ensuring, in this case, that these forests are properly protected. So there's both a lesson for the long term and certainly an immediate need for stronger and more effective assistance. What has happened is that because you've seen so many farmers pushed out of the forest into land surrounding Mompeko, that's created a much more of a demand for land in the surrounding villages, and that certainly has the potential to increase conflict over land between the displaced farmers, who are mostly from Burkina Faso, and the villagers from that area, who are from an ethnic group that has been there for a very long time.
Jim Warmington is the West Africa researcher for Human Rights Watch. He was speaking to Ricky Schreier from New York City. Government and opposition leaders in the Democratic Republic of Congo have reached an agreement that could pave the way to elections next year, but the political future for Congo remains very much unclear, given that no dates have been set and some top opposition parties are not even taking part in the talks. William Klaus has more from the Congolese capital, Kinshasa.
Representatives of the opposition and the government delegations announced the compromise late Wednesday. They said they have agreed to hold all the elections at the same time, if the technical and financial means allow it, and to delay the local polls if they do not.
Et qu'il fallait trouver très vite une solution dont nous ne devrions pas nous perdre dans plusieurs élections. Mais aujourd'hui, nous sommes mis d'accord pour dire.
The leader of the opposition delegation to the talks, Vital Cameron, told reporters We had to find a solution very quickly, and we agreed that we must find an order that does not violate the constitution. Camaray had marched his team out of the dialogue on Monday, after a disagreement over the sequencing of the polls. The opposition argued the presidential poll must come first. The president's side has long favoured holding local and provincial polls before the legislative and presidential elections. Speaking to reporters late Wednesday, Justice Minister Alexis Thambwe, who is leading President Joseph Kabila's delegation at the dialogue, raised the prospect of a government reshuffle to incorporate opposition members taking part in the talks. He said, "We will manage the country together," but did not give any further details. Some suspect that Camaray will become prime minister and several others will assume smaller portfolios in the new cabinet, which will be presented to the country as a government of national unity. Both delegations say that there will not be any polls until at least July 2017, the time it will take to conduct a full update of the voter roll. The vote was due in November, but the opposition has accused President Kabila of trying to cling to power beyond the constitutional two-term limit. Most of the main opposition parties have refused to participate in this dialogue. These parties have formed a coalition called Le Rassemblement, the Assembly, which is headed by veteran opposition politician Etienne Tshisekedi. They argue that the dialogue is simply a means for the president to buy time to change the constitution so that he can run again. Tshisekedi's former chief of staff, Albert Meleka, participated in the early stages of the talks before quitting. He spoke to VOA.
The absence of good faith on the part of Mr. Kabila's delegation, I don't see any reliable agreement coming out of this dialogue. Apparently the Rassemblement will reject such a government, especially with Mr. Camere as Prime Minister. The decision means that at least a part of the opposition has come to terms with Kabila remaining in power beyond its constitutional term. I think that's the main objective that Kabila has, just having some time beyond his legal term, so that maybe he can, you know, reorganize his own troops and put on the table again the idea of referendum or changing the constitution, so that somehow he can run again.
Le Rassemblement says it will hold a demonstration Monday to protest the Electoral Commission's failure to organize elections. William Clowes for VOA News, Kinshasa.
The United States says it will back an arms embargo on South Sudan if the country's government blocks the deployment of a regional protection force in the war-torn country and continues to block the movement of UN staffers and peacekeepers. VOA's East Africa correspondent Jill Craig talked to analysts who say an arms embargo has been used as a bargaining chip for far too long.
Better late than never. That's what analysts say about an arms embargo on South Sudan. A former arms expert on the UN panel of experts on South Sudan, Luc van de Vandervoort, told VOA the United States has used the threat of an arms embargo as leverage several times, including to get the government to sign a peace deal with rebels last year.
Both sides have committed the most egregious violations of human rights law and have been atrocities committed on a scale that we've not seen in many other contexts where an arms embargo has, in fact, been imposed. So it's normally the thing that you start with, not the thing you try to, not the end state.
South Sudan's conflict has killed tens of thousands since it started in December 2013 and displaced over 2 million. Aid agencies warn hundreds of thousands of people are on the brink of starvation. South Sudan has been free to engage in state-to-state transfers in arms without restrictions from sellers. Rights groups have been calling for an arms embargo on South Sudan for more than 2 years. Human Rights Watch senior researcher Jahan Henry says it is long overdue.
The weapons that enter South Sudan are inevitably used against civilians in this conflict, which is especially abusive. It is especially conducted against civilians, not a classic conflict between classic armies.
Britain and France have supported imposing an arms embargo, while in the past, other members of the UN Security Council have not. Russia says it is still too soon. Since July, government troops have been accused of fresh attacks on civilians, international aid workers, and U.S. diplomats. Some experts say arms embargoes in general don't work. They say there just isn't enough oversight of the global weapons trade to enforce them. Analysts VOA spoke to warned against attaching outsized expectations to one at this stage in South Sudan. Chatham House Horn of Africa research associate Ahmed Soliman said there is no substitute for a political solution.
If they've not acted in the spirit of the agreement since its signing, it doesn't seem as if it's going to change. And I would posit that an arms embargo is probably unlikely to change that. coupled with travel embargoes and other things, there is a symbolic nature to these sanctions, but that necessarily they're not going to alter the realities on the ground too much and too quickly, I don't think.
Several calls to South Sudan's presidential spokesman for comment went unanswered. Jill Craig, VOA News, Nairobi.
Protesters in South Africa have been expressing their grievances by torching buildings in a manner reminiscent of the anti-apartheid uprisings of the 1970s. The tactic has grown in popularity along with a student movement for free education and other changes at the nation's universities. VOA's Anita Powell reports from Johannesburg.
"They are burning memory," intoned the chancellor of the University of Johannesburg, as a room full of academics nodded gravely. Professor Njabula Ndebele was speaking of a growing trend, the torching of South African educational structures by student protesters. Like the anti-apartheid activists of the 1970s, protesters say they are living in a system that marginalizes Black South Africans socially, economically, linguistically, and philosophically. In February, students at the University of Cape Town set alight paintings of colonial leaders. That seems to have inspired other fires, most recently the torching of the law library at the University of KwaZulu-Natal. Often, the fires come at the climax of student protests demanding free education and greater support. Ndebele says today's protesters feel smothered by the legacy of apartheid.
"In the unfolding events, it became clearer that the incineration of collected white colonial objects as embodiments of whiteness was on the onset of a declared process to decolonize the University of Cape Town and rid it of aspects of its legacy that made for a campus environment in which it was impossible to breathe for those for whom such a legacy was not built and which they felt consigned them to silence."
Dozens of school buildings have also been torched this year amid protests over a myriad of issues, all with a common theme: that South Africa's post-apartheid government has not lived up to its promise. South African universities have reacted by embarking on a mission of decolonization, a term that means different things to different people. It has been defined as a restructuring of curricula to include African languages and philosophy, as a removal of colonial relics from universities, as a redressing of racial inequalities, and even as a return of white-owned land to its original owners. University of Johannesburg student Cleopatra Mutsila says the reason for the fires is simple. They capture attention.
"It's funny when we speak of when Black people continue to be oppressed in this country, when we speak of Black pain, and when Black people die each and every day in this country, nobody says anything. But then you burn a building in a white institution, everybody is up in arms and telling us that we are hooligans, we are this and that and that and that."
At 24, Mutsila is part of what is called South Africa's born free generation, born in the dying days of apartheid. But she says she is not free, and she will continue to protest until she is. Anita Powell, VOA News, Johannesburg.
And briefly, before we leave you, a summary of Africa news. The International Criminal Court has said it will start to focus on crimes linked to environmental destruction, the illegal exploitation of natural resources, and unlawful dispossession of land. That's it for this Friday, September 16th edition of Daybreak Africa. We thank you for spending this week with us. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, I'm James Butte in Washington, wishing all of you in Africa a very good weekend.
Tuesday on Health Chat, join host Lenore Modou discussing the importance of breastfeeding. It's not only the cornerstone for a child's healthy development, but also the foundation of a country's development. For your questions, email us at healthchat@voanews.com. You can also reach us by phone to leave a message or to participate in the program. We will call you back. Dial the international code for the United States, then dial 202-205-9942. The country code is 1. Dial 45 after you hear the station ID. For listeners to call during the show, our telephone number is 202-619-3111. Else chat this Tuesday at 1730 UTC, right here on VOA Africa.